Well, greetings out there to everybody at TFMR. Hey, it is Wednesday, December the 1st, but you are listening to this either on Thursday, December the 2nd or sometime thereafter. And this is your Thursday conversation. You haven't had one of these for a few weeks. We'll try to have a few more before the year ends. But this is an important one. As you can see on the headline title of this podcast, I am joined by Alistair McLeod. Alistair, of course, an old friend and director of research at Gold Money, and is a very astute observer of global economics, monetary policy, and the precious metals markets. And so I just feel fortunate to count him as a friend and as an asset here at TFMR. So Alistair, thank you for joining me again.
Craig, it's my pleasure, and it's lovely to talk to you again.
It is always lovely to talk with you, my friend. And the purpose of this call, and I don't intend it to be, you know, some lengthy thing. I don't know how long it'll end up being, but I want to focus entirely upon the Basel III changes, rules, and the implementation of them that is coming 1st of January, 1 month from today as we record this. Everybody here on the site, you know, we do Beer with Turd once a month. And last week we had all the questions that were sent in, and so many of them dealt with Basel III and what's going to happen. You know, is it going to make a change? Is it going to make an immediate change? Will it make any change at all? Will it take time for this to make an impact? That sort of thing. And as I was just telling Alistair, and as everybody knows, one of my lines is the older I get, the line gets pretty blurry between being a cynic and a realist. So I'm not sure what to expect come January, but I know Alistair's got some thoughts. And so I thought I'm going to bring Alistair in and just hear straight from him. So Alistair, that is a lengthy introduction. No one's hear me talk. Well, it's January the 1st. It's a month from today. What do we know now? Let's start there. What do we know now? What's going to change on January the 1st?
Okay. Well, I think before January the 1st, I should mention that most jurisdictions, including America and Europe, which are probably the two biggest ones that are of interest to us in the Western precious metals sort of market, investment scene, you know, monetary scene, however you like to describe it, they all became compliant or introduced regulations whereby banks had to become compliant, I'll just qualify that in a second, with the Basel III net stable funding ratio, and that was at the half-year stage at the end of June. Mm-hmm. When I say compliant, it's probably useful to just take a step back and say exactly what this net stable funding ratio is. Basically, what Basel III has done is it has tried to de-risk the banking system by ensuring in this particular set of regulations that banks are properly funded for the assets that they carry on the asset side of their balance sheet. So, for example, if a bank has very large depositors who can take the money out at a moment's notice, that is determined under the new rules as funding, which is in effect unstable. And you cannot use that to, if you like, apply to the other side of the balance sheet in terms of stable funding requirement. And it's the ratio between the available stable funding and the requirement for it which gives you the net stable funding ratio. Now, this means that a bank can run positions in assets which are deemed to require stable funding. And so long as they've got a sort of a general broad cover, that's probably okay. And what it means is that some things are more efficient from a balance sheet point of view than other things. Let's take a very simple example. If a bank, let us say, has reserves held at the central bank, that is regarded as a stable asset, which won't require an awful lot of available stable funding from the liability side of the commercial bank's balance sheet.
Okay.
If, on the other hand, the assets shown on the asset side are derivatives, and we're not just talking gold, silver, you know, copper, oil, we're talking any sort of derivative. Derivatives on the other side of the balance sheet require stable funding from the liabilities side. Now, interestingly, the best form of funding that a bank can have is diverse small depositors whose balances are within the guarantee, which is generally provided either by the banking system or by the government, guaranteeing small deposits, which I think in the United States is something like $250,000 or something,
yep,
whatever it is. So anything under that is regarded as extremely good, available, stable funding. Now, a treasurer trying to run the overall bank's balance sheet is going to want to have enough leeway on that available, stable funding and other forms of funding which are determined to be relatively stable, to apply to the asset side of the balance sheet. Now, the treasurer is going to turn around and not really want to see very much in the way of assets that are required to chew up the available stable funding on the liability side. So you can see that this is actually a very broad and complex situation. Into this, of course, we have got one form of derivatives, which is of particular interest to all of us, and that is futures and forward transactions in precious metals, particularly gold and silver.
Right.
Those basically, it's a very inefficient use of your balance sheet to have these things on your asset, on the asset side of your balance sheet. So a bank, let us say, which has forward positions in London as of the beginning of next year, which is when this applies in London. I mean, we're going to be late on this. It's really from the first business day of next year. But you can expect banks to already be planning to introduce these measures on their balance sheets and the way they run their balance sheets as of now. In fact, they've been planning this over the last year, I should think, at least, because they've known about this coming. I mean, this is not a surprise. So what they will be doing is they'll be looking at the situation in London with an LBMA member, which typically runs a position where they've got deposits on the one side of their balance sheet, and the deposits, the value of those deposits are linked to, say, the gold price. And on the other side of the balance sheet, they may have derivatives to cover those. Now, unfortunately, they can't actually use those derivatives to cover a sort of a general mishmash of deposits, which whose liabilities to the bank are tied to the gold price. So this is a problem. Now, there has been, I think it's regulation 428 subsection F from memory, but yeah, you know, please don't hold me to it, but I think that was the one, whereby on application to the Bank of England, where, you know, which basically runs the PRA, which is the regulator, it hosts the regulator, a bullion bank can offset an asset, in other words, let us say a futures or a forward position, against a specific liability on the other side of its balance sheet, but it has to get permission in order to do so. So you've got this situation where there are one or two little things which can be done, but in general, really from when this applies in London, which is when it affects the LBMA members, they're going to have to convince their treasurers and the directors of the bank, who are responsible for all the activities, that running these books, unbalanced positions, whereby the bank takes a punt, if you like, on the short side in the futures market on COMEX, or takes a punt, let us say, writing options, in other words, selling options on gold and silver into the market uncovered, this is such a profitable opportunity that they will make more than make up the return on which they would get if they use their balance sheet more efficiently, if you see what I mean. So we've got this situation where it is absolutely unclear as to how this thing is going to proceed, other than in a general knowledge that the hurdles for a bullion bank to make profits out of running derivative positions in gold and silver, those hurdles are just getting higher and higher and higher. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best way to regard this thing. I mean, I think a lot of people have sort of taken the view that, you know, the new regulations come in the case of America, it was end of June. In the case of London, it's first business day of 2022. You know, from that moment, banks must comply with the new regulations. That is not the case. The regulations basically tell the banks how they must run their overall balance sheet. They don't actually turn around and say, you must do this, you must do that, specific to any one particular element on the asset side or indeed on the liability side of the balance sheet. So this is, I think the way to look at it is the hurdles for a bullion bank in terms of making money out of dealing in futures, running a book position, an uneven position in futures or options or forwards, the hurdles are just getting higher and higher. Now, we've seen there is obviously a desire to try and control the extent of outstanding positions. And we've seen this. I mean, this happens all the time anyway, but we've particularly seen this in the recent weeks when we find that open interest on COMEX has been driven down from a high, I think, on the 17th of November of 620,000 odd contracts. Currently, well, last night it was down to 531,868 contracts. So you can see that they have jumped on the weak positions in the market to try and reduce their overall position. Bear in mind that on the short side of the market, net short, that is, you have the producers who traditionally would hedge into the market. And that also includes banks working on their behalf. And you have the bullion banks and other sort of various sundry dealers who are categorized as swaps. It is those two, basically, who stand on the short side of the market to allow the speculators and particularly the sort of, if you like, money managers who are hedge funds to take long positions. Now, the hedge funds, as we know, and I know I'm talking to someone here who knows an awful lot more of this about this than I do, but I think I can say quite simply, Craig, that hedge funds just do a pairs trade. All they're interested in is sell dollar, buy gold, or sell gold, buy dollar. I mean, that's the way they look at it. They're not really interested in anything else. And so they are effectively the worst sort of counterparty you could possibly have in a futures market, because you can take out their stops. I mean, if you're powerful enough as on the short side, which collectively is the position that the swaps are in, they can take out these guys without any problem whatsoever.
Which is what they did last week.
Yeah, as they have done in recent weeks. I mean, you know, and this is evidence from, the outstanding interest going down from over 620,000 contracts to 530 contracts. I mean, this is, you know, it's simple. And I think that process, it feels to me like they haven't finished with it yet. And looking at what's happening to the price of silver today, which is very sensitive to this sort of move. I mean, I've got silver at $22.45 at the moment. I mean, that's way down when you bear in mind that not so long ago, I think back in June, I mean, we touched almost $30. So this is the typical bear raid, if you like, to take out all these weak hands. The only constraint on this really is what's happening on the physical side. And that is very interesting because the more they push the market down, the more physical bullion basically disappears from the market, because the people who genuinely want bullion are not these flighty fund managers, who are interested in the profits today and, tomorrow will take care of itself. We're talking about central banks who are concerned about their overall reserves. We're talking about, the mega rich, the ultra rich, the big, big family offices, mm-hmm. who have some, members who are old fashioned enough to know that that gold is money. And, currencies are not money. Currencies are something completely different. And you've got to protect yourself against the depreciation of currencies. These guys know what they're doing. And the thing that's interesting is that while all this stuff has been going on, the amount of bullion held in the LBMA vaults has actually diminished. I mean, if I look at the last 2 months, according to the LBMA, vaulted gold has declined by 57 tons. Now, you would think with this sort of thing going on that, if there was any loose gold to be shaken out, that the amount of gold being stored would actually increase. But no, it is decreasing. So where is it going? And also bear in mind that the ETFs have been selling, and in the last 2 months, they've liquidated about 41 tons. On top of that, there has been a supply into the market, which in London runs at roughly, I think if we say something like 50 tons a week, it's probably not too far out. It might be a little over the top, but it's not too far out. So that's over 2 months, that's another 400 tons. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is quite significant tonnages disappearing from, from sight, if you like. So, the big money, the sensible money, the money that actually understands that gold is money and currencies are currencies, basically is just cleaning the place out. And, from what I can understand, the big Swiss refiners, I mean, if you want to go to them and get some bullion in size, say, 10 tons, 15 tons, whatever, it's drawing the queue. I mean, they're now quoting something like way out, sort of 8-10 weeks out, that sort of thing. There's no way that there's anything really readily available. And we've seen also that on COMEX, we have seen deliveries pick up. I mean, only yesterday, the contracts delivered in physical were 9,581. If you take that with the preceding few days, over the last week, roughly 1 million ounces has been delivered out of COMEX. Now, COMEX is not meant to be a delivery market, but it's turning into that. Yeah, I mean, this is just... Yeah, so anyway, that's my take on the situation. I mean, what we have, so to summarize, basically, is that we have got a situation where the rules are changing. It's going to make it less profitable for banks to run balance sheets in such a way that they generate their profits from wheeling and dealing in gold, silver, oil, copper, whatever it might be, or even, derivatives in other things. So they're going to have to, in time, basically alter their overall strategy. But there is not a requirement for them to do that absolutely tomorrow, or in the case of the LBMA membership, from January the 2nd next year. I just look at it as a bit of a movable feast, if you like. I think that's probably the best way to describe it.
If I were to summarize that, that's about how I was looking at it too, Alistair. There is, don't expect, I mean, if there's a smash of $30, during the LBMA session or during a COMEX session on January the 5th, don't just throw up your hands and go, well, that was a nothing burger. Because there are going to be people out there, that just want a simple explanation. And they're so desperate to have this over with, as you and I are. But there is a, but, beginning January 1, there is, let's call it a financial disincentive for the banks to continue the bullion business the way they always have. Now, whether or not the higher ups in the banks that oversee, you know, all of their commercial operations say, yeah, that's such a disincentive. We got to close up that bullion banking shop. Whether or not it reaches that level is going to vary from bank to bank. And maybe it becomes such an illiquid situation in London that they lose, you know, their centuries old power that they have because nobody wants to operate there anymore. And the banks, you know, one by one, get out of that business. Is that kind of, I don't want to say best case scenario, but is that the likely way that it plays out, that, you know, banks start to just kind of like Scotiabank, you know, just say, hey, you know what, screw it. We're not going to do this. Is not worth our time anymore.
Absolutely. And I think the two other points worth making. I think there has been, in these unregulated derivatives markets, there has been, so much illegal dealing. Banks have been fined huge numbers.
Yep.
And one of them in particular has been, found guilty of criminal action, or at least its trading, its precious metals trading desk has. So, this is the sort of thing that really has got to cease. The other thing I would like to say is that I'm sort of trying to put myself in the Bank of England's shoes. Now, you and I and anyone listening to this podcast will appreciate that China has effectively cornered the physical gold market, while we have been, in the West, we've been sort of luxuriating in derivatives and sort of, not really paying much attention to what's going on in the physical. But there is no doubt that China has substantially cornered the physical market. And I think that part of this, as far as the Bank of England is concerned, and the flexibility that they have built into the situation to allow the settlement system to continue to work, I think part of that is what they want to do is to retain a degree of control over the physical market. So I think we need to look at it also from that point of view. So this is going to drift, I think, away from derivatives generally towards a more physical market approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a good thing.
Yes.
Now, having said that, I don't know that this is really important to us because, the economic events that are evolving very, very rapidly. And, the idea that you can sort of, let's say, over the next 18 months to 2 years, gradually evolve into a more physical market. I don't know that the fiat currency world has got that time available. I just look at what's going on in the United States and what's going on in Europe. I mean, I've written two articles, first on the US and the second on the Eurozone. I mean, in the US, what I see is rising interest rates because the purchasing power of the dollar is going down. I mean, I don't know how many people actually realize this, but since the end of February last year, your M1, which they've recast, has increased by 400%. And that is in less than 2 years. Now, you don't do that with money and expect prices to remain stable.
Right.
There is a lot of price rises, or put more accurately, loss of purchasing power for the dollar, not measured against other currencies necessarily, but measured in terms of commodities, labor costs, transportation costs, coming out in producer prices, and also therefore in consumer prices. Now, these are going to be a lot more serious than the 6.2, which we've seen so far at the CPI level, a lot more serious. And anyway, we know that the CPI figures are, don't actually reflect the reality on the ground in America. So what that means is that higher interest rates are going to undermine financial assets. Undermining financial assets is something that the Fed does not want to see, for the very simple reason that it has followed a policy, even from Greenspan's days, of juicing financial assets so that confidence in the underlying economy is maintained. Now, you may say that's a very odd way of going about it, but that's basically what they have been doing. So if you get a substantial bear market, which you will get with significant rises in interest rates, then that basically is going to undermine the economy, and it is going to mean that the foreigners who own something like 14 trillion in equities, apart from what they've also got in bonds, they're going to be sellers. They're not going to hang around. What they do with the dollar is a different issue. But you're going to see a very substantial collapse in financial asset prices, and that's bound to undermine the dollar. And now the precedent for this was John Law in 1720 France, who did exactly the same thing with the Mississippi bubble. He puffed it up by printing money, which is what QE is, it effectively is, to push the share prices up and to maintain them at a high level. And it began to fail. It began to fail because people turned sellers. People had to sell in that case because he had a system of promoting things on a partly paid basis. And of course, calls had to be paid, which basically meant the stock had to be sold in order to pay the calls. So he needed to print money to buy the stock which was being sold. But what happened? I mean, within something like 6 months, the shares, the Mississippi shares had fallen from over 10,000 livres, which was John Law's unbacked currency at the time, to around about 3,000 livres. Now, that's a pretty good bear market, let's face it. What happened to the livre? The livre went from whatever it was to unquoted on the main foreign exchanges in London and Amsterdam. And that, there was no quote for the livre in September. So basically, you destroy financial assets, you destroy the currency as well, if you have used the currency in order to support financial assets. So that, to my mind, is what's going to happen in America. I cannot see any way out of it.
Right.
The euro is a very different situation. The euro, basically, you may not believe this, but the central bank system, so I'm talking about the ECB and all the national central banks, their balance sheet totals around about, it's a short 9 trillion euros. But if you look at the repo market, and I'm looking at repos and reverse repos, which don't coincide because a repo is the other side of a reverse repo, that is well in excess now of €10 trillion. That is a huge number. Mm-hmm. So what we have is a system which is relying on the short-term repo, rolling over refinancing. Now, a lot of the collateral which goes into those repos is bad collateral. And it's bad collateral because what's happened is that local regulators in Italy, for example, have turned around and said, non-performing loan, well, if you get it off our patch, we will say that this is performing so that you can use it as collateral. So this means that an Italian bank can take non-performing loans because the regulators looked at it and put his stamp on it and said it's okay. He can then lend it to the Bank of Italia in return for a repo. So what you have is you've got bad debts just sort of being, put into the system. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is that the interest rate on a repo in Europe is 0%. So what happens when interest rates rise? Well, you've got a 10 trillion plus repo mountain that is going to start contracting. Now, when the repo market starts contracting, then effectively what you're saying is that bank balance sheets are contracting because that's what happens when repos, start, diminishing and not replaced by anything else. And so we're looking at contracting balance sheets in a system where to have a gearing between assets and equity, balance sheet gearing of as much as 30 times is not that unusual. I mean, this is, so what we can see is a complete banking system collapse, which is going to take the euro down completely.
Which makes Alistair, that impacts, you know, what we started talking about with Basel III
So, you know, coming back to the physical bullion market, I can tell you that the smart money in Europe is looking at this situation in the euro. I mean, you know, for example, Swiss and German investors or family offices or, you know, the big old money. I mean, they're looking at this and thinking, this is very dangerous. This is not something that we want to be exposed to. We have got to take something to protect ourselves. So they are buying physical gold and they're stashing it away. Yeah. So this is why gold is going out of places like London and perhaps going into vaults in Switzerland.
Right.
So I don't know what the Swiss vaulting situation is, but we can see that this physical gold is disappearing from the market. And not only that, but I mean, you've got central banks like the Croatian Central Bank who've decided to take their gold out of the main trading centers and take it home. I mean, they're having to build vaults in order to store the stuff. So, you know, this, I just don't see how this situation can continue for very long. Cans have been kicked down the road. And, you know, we're now in the situation where I think reality is rather going to intervene.
Well, Alistair, you set up a rather interesting scenario for when the calendar flips. That's for sure. I'm fearful of a number of things in 2022. And you just wonder if some of those dominoes start to tumble, as you suggest, how that could speed things along. In terms of, and again, let's just double back to the beginning, just so everybody knows at least what you and I think is going to happen beginning on the 1st of January, is that it's not that the bullion banks are forced out of the business or that they are forced to immediately allocate against all their positions. The regulation, in a sense, just makes it more cost prohibitive for them to continue doing what they're doing. Is that the simplest?
Yes, that I think is the way to look at it. Absolutely.
Okay. So they can continue doing it. Just like, obviously, I mean, you mentioned open interest going up in gold over the last month. It went from 510,000 to 620,000. Now we're back to 530,000, where the bank, you know, swap dealer traders just take the short side and issue the new contracts and the specs looking, you know, anyway, we already went over that. Yep. So they're still doing that. But this definitely serves as a disincentive to keep business as usual. And perhaps would over time see changes as to how the global gold market operates. Is that a fair way to sum it up?
I think it's a fair way to sum it up. And I like to put myself in the shoes of the management of a bank. I mean, I've been a director of a bank. So, you know, I've got sort of, you know, perhaps a, I hope, a little bit of, you know, an idea as to how these guys might think. If you start seeing the price of gold rising, even if they manage to contain the level of open interest on COMEX, contain the situation in London, which in a sense I think might be easier to do, actually, even though the London market is 8 times the size of COMEX. But the way I would see it is that I think there will come a point where the management of the bank is likely to turn around and say, we really don't want to be in this business anymore.
Right.
It's, you know, so, okay, you know, our traders have done extremely well. They've been a very good source of profits for us and all the rest of it. But we can see what's happening now to the dollar. We can see inflation. We can see rising interest rates. The precious metals prices are continuing to rise. We probably don't understand why, you know, this is so, but we can see that this is a situation where, the end of fiat currencies may be in sight. Now, under those circumstances, we don't really want to be short of gold in particular. So this is something that we ought to really think hard about wrapping up. So I think that that point might well come. I mean, and if we see the price of gold going over $2,000, for example, which I is quite likely, I think you'll find that the banks will try and bail out of the market as much as they can. But the problem then is that the squeeze will be on them. Yeah. And so they've got to be very, very careful as, if you like, a cohort as to how they extricate themselves from this situation. I mean, when this has happened in the past, generally a bank has got itself into sort of big trouble and had to be rescued. And it's always been a very quiet rescue. Nobody actually, you know, there's nothing publicly happened.
Well, you did, and the JP Morgan Silver Desk in 2011 comes to mind.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, but is JP Morgan big enough to absorb that sort of thing? So, yeah. You know, okay, it hurts. My goodness, it hurts. But, you know, I'm thinking of some of the smaller banks, you know, who will find that actually, basically, they've gone bust on this.
Right.
And you cannot afford to have any bank fail. So they must be bailed out.
Right.
So this is going to be this. I mean, it could be that in 2022 that what happens to the gold price becomes central to the financial system. Mm-hmm. You know, apart from the dangers which I pointed out that mm-hmm. the euro system actually faces from rising interest rates. You know, separately, this could be a major problem, I think, for the bullion bank community.
And you reminded me, Alistair, I mean, this is anecdotal, I suppose, but it's a couple of years ago when Andrew Bailey was still the head of the PRA.
Yeah.
Before he became the head of the Bank of England, Andrew Maguire told me about a meeting he had. There was a guy that Andy knows, that a member of parliament that read into the record all of this stuff, all the manipulation stuff and the risks the banks were taking.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the, you know, they had like a lottery system or however that works over there, your ball gets picked and you can actually read, you know, whatever. Into the formal record of parliament. And this guy did that. Well, anyway, that got him a meeting with Andrew Bailey, who had no idea of the risk that all these banks were taking. And he was like, as Andy tells it, Andy Maguire said, he like threw up his hands. He says, you're telling me, you know, 11 years or whatever it was after the financial crisis, these banks are still have this kind of open-ended liability. We can't stroke them checks again, like we did 10 years ago to get out of that. It'll never fly.
Yep.
So, you know, if Andy's correct in relaying that information, well, then again, that shows you that Andrew Bailey, who now is the head of Bank of England, he knows the stuff's out there.
They can't risk. I mean, I've obviously watched Andrew Bailey, and what's my opinion of him? I mean, he was taken on basically as he was seen as a safe pair of hands by the political class. I must say that his knowledge of economics is zero. I mean, it really is. But I could equally say that for the Monetary Policy Committee. I mean, they're all Keynesians to the core. Yeah. The only person who wasn't a Keynesian was Andy Haldane, who is the chief economist, who resigned in the middle of this year, saying that inflation is a problem. So, while everybody else was, you know, was saying, no, it isn't. Anyway, Andy Haldane has gone on to other things, but you can see that the sort of caliber, if you like, of management at the top of the central banks is wanting, let's put it that way.
Maybe that's not so
helpful. And when I look at the situation in the Eurozone with Christine Lagarde, I mean, she is a lawyer, not an economist. She knows nothing about economics. Again, she was appointed because she was viewed as a safe pair of hands. Now, you may not have noticed this, but Jens Weidemann, who was head of the Bundesbank. I mean, he's handed in his cards and said, you know, I want to go back gardening for my and looking after my family from December. Please, can I leave early? Now, you know, you don't get someone who's as shrewd as Weidemann, and you know, and a young, ambitious man, resigning like that to go gardening. I mean, you know, look, it just doesn't happen. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't believe. I don't believe the narrative. I think that both Haldane and Weidemann know that any attempt to, from their point of view, to try and control the inflationary outcome of all the money printing that's been done on COVID and everything else, they're on a losing wicket. They're getting absolutely nowhere. They're getting sidelined.
Yeah.
So there is no point in them being associated with the failure.
Right.
That, I think, is the point. Now, right. My own personal hope, and I'm not a German, so I've got
you
no
sound like one.
Saying this. Well, Hemke is a German name.
Right, right.
Anyway.
That accent flows rather easily off the tongue for me, too. It's just genetic. But anyway, go ahead.
But I would sincerely hope for Europe that when the Eurozone collapses, that, and it will, of that I have no doubt. And I, you know, anyone who wants to understand why, go to goldmoney.com, go to Insights, read my article on the Eurozone, and then try and deny that there is a problem, if you like. But my hope is that when the euro collapses, that Weidemann will return to the scene and steer Germany towards sound money and away from this ridiculous currency situation. We're going to need men like him in Europe. And now Europe is terribly important because it is a fractured, diverse continent. With national identities. And if you're going to get a currency collapse, then you've got the situation for a civil war, potentially.
Right.
I don't actually see that problem in America because America is comprised of descendants and actual immigrants. And, they're people who went there for a better life. They went there essentially to benefit from free markets. So I think that the Americans will rally very rapidly after a dollar collapse and support a move back to sound money. I don't see the same thing with Europe. Europe, I think the political situation is far more fractious and potentially dangerous. So we're going to need good men like Weidemann to steer the continent out of a currency collapse.
Yeah.
I think that to me is extremely important. It really is.
Well, I put that on the list of stuff that we're going to be talking about next year. No doubt about that. Well, I always learn so much talking to you, and I know everybody else feels that way when they listen. And I just so much value your friendship and your time, and you've given me far more than I was hoping to get from you. So thank you so much, Alistair. It's just always great to visit with you. And I hope you have a great Christmas, great holiday season. Get some rest.
It's always a pleasure talking to you. And what I would like to do, if I may, is plug James Turk's new book.
Oh, which certainly.
It's just been published. It's called Money and Liberty.
I'm going to have him on to talk about it.
You get him? Yeah, absolutely. And it's $19.99. Now I've read it. there's a Kindle version for $9.99. That's priced in dollars. And I can tell you that it's well written. It's not difficult to understand. So for anyone who wants to actually understand what we're talking about from the economic point of view, from the money point of view, from the currency point of view, from the credit point of view, I think it's a very, very useful read. And, the way I look at it, I think it was Keynes who said, no, he was quoting Stalin, I think, that, not one man in a million understands money. So that means that 999,999 don't understand money. Read this book, and it'll lift you out of that large supermajority.
Money and Liberty?
It's called Money and Liberty.
Okay. I'll put a link. You know what? I'll dig up an Amazon link or something and I'll put it on this page.
Yeah, I think it would be worthwhile. And I think, Christmas present for doubting friends and relatives. That's what I'm going to do anyway.
Precisely. Now you got me thinking. I'm I'm going to reach out to James, see if we can get him in here before Christmas time to give that the old 1-2 punch.
I'm sure he'd be delighted to. I'm sure he would be delighted to come on. Yeah.
I will certainly do that. Alistair, hey, Merry Christmas, all that stuff. Like I said,
Merry Christmas to you and to all the Turdites.
Well, I know they appreciate that. I know they appreciate that. It is it's a growing little community we have here around the globe. And we all are looking forward to having a little restful time. But then, man, it's going to be on come the 1st of January. It's going to be a crazy year. And I think this has really helped for people to understand what those changes will mean and, you know, how that's going to not so much immediately impact things, but gradually impact things as the year progresses, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Alistair, thanks so much. And all the best everyone on your end.
Very much my pleasure. And happy Christmas to you all.
Thank you. And from everybody here at TFMR, thanks for listening. We'll get Mr. Turk in here soon. We'll have another Thursday conversation for you, maybe as soon as next week.